assume you've seen SpongeBob SquarePants at some point. Like,
yes.
Every once in a while, they'll cut to a close-up of him or something, and they'll make him look so realistic.
But they only keep it on screen for a couple seconds, and it's not moving. So, like, they know, like, they're using that very intentionally, right? Because they're like, okay, this is really going to gross people out. If they, like, animated that, nobody, people would be like, ah, like, ooh, I don't want to, like, watch that, you know?
We recently launched a new course called Character Design Fundamentals, and today we're chatting with the absurdly talented Emma Gillette, who teaches the course. She is a professional illustrator with a degree in animation, so kind of the perfect person to teach this class. Emma has a super interesting background, and we get into all of it. We talk about her college experience at Brigham Young University, which I did not know until recently has a very well-regarded animation program. We also talk about the experience she had when she was still a member of the Mormon faith of going on a church mission to Thailand and how that experience actually helped her navigate the career that she's chosen. And of course, we talk a lot about drawing, the psychology of character design, and much more. If you love character design, illustration, or basically anything related to the world of art, you're gonna love Emma. So let's get to the interview. Emma, it is awesome to have you on the podcast. You know, we've been working together for the past several months, but I feel like I haven't really gotten an opportunity to just like pick your brain and really get to know you. So I'm excited about this. Thank you for doing it. How you feeling?
Feeling good. Feeling a little nervous, but I don't know. It's different. I don't know why talking to a camera sometimes feels less scary than talking live.
Yeah, well, we did right before we started recording, we did figure out how to get like a little teleprompter set up so you can actually look at me and not just a camera lens, which is always helpful. So I wanted to start with this. So, you know, I know a lot about your work because, you know, we've been working together on the class and I've looked at your work and I've seen you drawing stuff for the class, but I actually didn't realize until yesterday when I was like doing my deep dive into you that your BFA, so you have a Bachelor of Fine Arts, it came from BYU, and that's not a school that I typically associate with like, you know, design and animation, but it turns out they actually have an amazing animation program. It's like got a really good reputation, and Pixar recruits from there and Disney. And so I was curious to just like, what is that program like? What was it like going to BYU and studying art there?
Yeah. So it is kind of funny that this little town, you know, Provo in the middle of Utah has what's considered, or at least when I was there, it was kind of considered the animation program in the country, other than CalArts and Ringling. Kudos goes to Brent Adams, who's the guy that started the program. He just like put his heart and soul into that program. He recently retired last year, I think. But it's this great program. It's small. It's really competitive. And it was awesome. Like, I am still best friends with the people that were in my class when I was there. I married my co-director from our student film.
As you do.
Yeah, as you do. It just, we were a great team on the film. We're like, oh, we might as well do life together, I guess.
Just keep it going, right?
Yeah. It's a fantastic program. I really enjoyed it. It's really great for people who want to become shaders, texture artists, or riggers. It's very 3D heavy over there. But they've got Sam Nielsen, who's kind of like the head of the more artsy side of the department, and he's an incredible artist as well. So like, I was still able to get a pretty decent art training there. Sometimes I've gone back and wondered like, well, would I have been better off doing illustration since I'm more illustration now? But I think having the background of the animation pipeline is just unique to me now, and I feel like it's only helped me and the connections that I made in the program. I've gotten so many jobs just from the relationships that I built over there. So yeah, super, super cool program. It's its own little world in the BYU campus. Like, you know, BYU is a very, they pump out lawyers and business people. And then you had this kind of like tiny little group of
the creative types.
Yeah, the creative types. And I was actually telling my husband that I think animation people are my people, and I really miss being around just that type of, I don't know, the creative, the fun. Like, I have memories of sneaking onto campus with my friends, and because the animation program had special access to the building for, because you have to be there overnight to like watch renders or, you know, like stuff like that. So we would go up with Nerf guns and like turn off all the lights and like spend all night like playing zombie Nerf gun battle. It just like that, that sense of community and fun is something that's like really, I don't think that's unique to BYU animation. I kind of feel like that's just like people who go into animation are just fun. And so that was,
yeah,
I really miss that. And I wouldn't trade that experience for the world. It was super awesome.
So I think, you know, so I taught for a year at Ringling. And, you know, one of the things that I was curious about, so at Ringling, like I think a lot of, you know, like well-known art schools, there's a little bit of a selection bias, right? So like when you're teaching there, you're like, oh my God, like, you know, these kids are amazing. Like they're so talented. And some of that, I think, comes from the fact that you're at a place with a really good reputation, and it brings in people from all over the world. And, you know, and at Ringling and at most art schools, you have to apply. You have to have some kind of portfolio and be good enough to get in. I assume BYU is the same. But what I was curious about is, you know, a school like Ringling, you've students from all over the planet coming in, and they're from all different backgrounds. And BYU, for people who don't know, by the way, because a lot of people listening are in the United States may not know this, it's Brigham Young University. It's a Mormon university. And maybe you can speak to this, Emma, like how much the Mormon thing actually plays into the education and all of that. But I would imagine that most of the students there are Mormon. And so you're already pulling from a much smaller population than like the global population of artists, right? So I'm curious, like how competitive was it to get into that program? Were the students there, were they already, did a lot of them already have talent? Like, you know, I look at your work and I assume you probably went to BYU with a pretty awesome portfolio already. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that and, you know, how much maybe the Mormon aspect of it played into the culture there and just the types of artists that you were around.
Yeah, it's so that is a unique thing to the BFA at BYU is because it's not an art school. So like I have friends who went to CalArts and it was like Fridays was their general education day. You know, most of the week you're in your art classes. And then on Fridays, it was like a little bit of math or a little bit of history or whatever. BYU, it's still like you had to get a certain amount of like writing credits and math. So it was like on top of trying to do all my art stuff, which would take up all my time, it was like also running back and forth between my general education classes and like barely sliding through, you know, C's in those classes just so I could graduate so I could focus on my animation stuff. And at BYU, you do, because it's a religious education, you also have to take religious credits. So every right. semester you have to be in a Bible or a Book of Mormon class. So it is unique in that you're kind of getting like kind of a hodgepodge of education on top of your artistic education. And yeah, most of the students are Mormon. You get some people, like one of my good friends, Gonzo, who he's working over at Riot Games, I think. He actually, so never Mormon, but like knew that a lot of game studios were hiring out of BYU at the time. So he just like emailed one of our professors and was like, hey, here's my animation portfolio. Can I get into BYU? Which BYU is kind of hard to get into now. And they liked his portfolio so much. And I think a lot of times BYU students maybe aren't as talented as some of the like art kids that are getting into like Ringling. Like we kind of start at a lower level because you have to focus on academics to get into BYU. Like art doesn't get you into BYU, academics does. So we kind of start here and then it's like a lot of grinding to kind of catch up. But his portfolio was so great that they just like automatically got him into BYU, pulled him into the program because they're like, we want like an animation talent because we didn't have a lot of animators at the time. So who were like animation focused in the program. So yeah, he was like one of like two or three non-Mormons in the school. And he's like such an awesome guy. So yeah, Mormonism definitely does play a big part. And I think Mormons have a very emphasis on like work ethic and like working hard. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that is one of the reasons why a lot of people hire out of BYU is that there's kind of a chip on BYU students' shoulder to like prove themselves to like, okay, we got to catch up to these, you know, Ringling and CalArts kids, and like they pull a lot of all-nighters trying to make up that gap.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's funny. I we were talking before, I was telling you, like, I grew up in Texas, and there weren't like a ton of Mormons in my town in Fort Worth, but just randomly, two of my best friends who I was in a band with, my high school band, were Mormons. And so I got to learn a little bit about the culture, and I went to their church with them a few times. And I definitely did notice that there's like, there is kind of this like, you know, and I know Mormons also tithe, you know, like a certain percentage of their salary. So there is kind of this like commitment to doing things that are difficult that I noticed even in high school. So you mentioned grinding. That was the term you used. Someone to ask about that. You know, I think it's unsurprising that if the college is a general education program with art school on top, you're going to attract a different set of students, right? And they may come in with less technical ability early. So how do you get good in that environment? What are the things, you know, I'm always curious about this because honestly, the best students I worked with at Ringling came to Ringling really, really good already. And then, you know, mostly you're trying to stay out of their way and help them when they need help and let them ask you for things. But you don't have to like force the best people to get good. But when someone comes in and they need to grind, what does BYU's program do? Like, how do you get good at, and especially with drawing, you know, that it's a technical skill and there's muscle memory involved. So what was that like?
Animation students at BYU don't sleep or socialize or like they live on campus and that's all they do. They're constantly working on personal projects on top of homework and on top of the general, like I don't know that I've met more like single-minded people than my friends in the BYU program. Like it's so incredible. It's mind blowing to see the first years who get in the program, which they only allow 25 people into the program because they really do want to weed out the people that already had some talent from the people who just thought like, oh, well, I got into BYU and animation sounded fun. They really wanted, they only want the people that are already kind of artistically inclined. And so most students at BYU have an artistic eye or are creative. They just maybe didn't spend as much time as some of the kids at Ringling who've been doing that their whole, and like that was the only thing that they did, you know, in high school instead of being valedictorians in their high schools. And so like I have friends who they started out and like they were pumping out some cool stuff, like really cool renders. Cause that's your first year at BYU, is a lot of making 3D scenes, getting the lighting and the textures and stuff right. And then by the end of the program, they're like the most mind-blowing painters. Like, I'm like, how did you go from like being really, you know, like you had some cool renders at the beginning of this program and now you're like a lead background designer for Steven Universe. Like they just, and it was because they were literally always on campus or painting at home. Like our friend group was our class and we hung out by staying up late and practicing painting, critiquing, doing drawovers for each other. Just like a really intense dedication to the craft that we'd chosen.
That's amazing. And maybe that's what it takes, right? To especially for something, you know, like I know you have a BFA in animation, but now you're a professional illustrator. You know, I'm always struck by illustration specifically because you can't, I don't know, I feel like it's harder to fake in some ways. Like you can, you know, if you learn enough tricks, you know, maybe it's different for character animation, but like in motion design, there's enough tricks that you can lean on to appear good. In illustration, I feel like there's less of those. You actually have to be good to get good at it.
And I've because I had the animation background, I've felt like my whole career has been almost like a second education in like teaching myself the ins and outs of illustration. So maybe some of my BYU background helped me with the like commitment to being like, all right, I suck at this now, but I can figure it out.
Yeah. So speaking of like on that same topic, speaking of, you know, having to beat your head against something over and over again. I bet a lot of people listening don't know this either. So I don't know if it's every Mormon or most Mormons. When you go to college, I think you stop after a year or two and you go on what's called a mission. And I'll let you explain what that is, but I'd love to hear your story. And if you were with your husband, it'd be cool to hear what was your mission like? And then I have some follow-up questions.
Okay, cool. Yeah, so my husband and I aren't associated with the Mormon Church anymore. We're not religious, but our missions were and are still very near and dear experiences to our hearts. A mission in the Mormon Church, if you're a boy, it's 2 years, and if you're a girl, it's 18 months. And you kind of just like... They call you to wherever they want you to go. So like some people go to Idaho, some people go to London. My husband and I both went, we didn't know each other when we were on our missions, but I went to Thailand and he went to the Philippines. So I feel very lucky that I got to do my 18 months in like a really cool place in the world. But yeah, it's basically, a big kind of like door-to-door salesman, like the... like the people that sell vacuums or whatever, but for LDS.
For religion. Yeah.
For the religion.
Yeah.
And you literally eat and breathe. Like you don't call your family. You don't watch movies. You wake up early in the morning. You hit the streets. You talk to anything that has a pulse. And you do that from sunup to sundown for 18 months straight. Like, the religion part was a big piece of it, but also like I was walking random villages in rural Thailand or like in the slums of Bangkok. Like I got so many amazing experiences. It was a huge world widening experience for me, be in this like just talking to people that I would have never met before. I had the experience of being able to visit. I met this guy who his dad was like the head monk of their local temple, and he was in the hospital, so we got to hang out with him while he was recuperating. I just met a lot of really cool people that widened my view of the world. And then the highs and lows of meeting single mothers in a slum or like the Buddhists, like I just the stories that were like just sinking into my brain, I feel like that has informed my art. In 18 months, I almost got like 10 years of life experience that I feel personally informs my art. And I think my husband would say the same with his experiences. He like lived in a fishing village for 6 months or something like that. The people are so cool. Like, I don't know. Even without the religious element now to like have it make meaning for me, it just the life experience. I don't know. It's something that I want my kids to go out and have like a living abroad experience, because I think that especially for Americans where we kind of are, I feel like we're a little
we don't
bit
travel
like
as
this.
Much anyway. Yeah,
yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. It's really important, I think, to go and see that. There's more that we don't know than what we do know. And I think that's
absolutely
kind of what art is sharing experience. And it's having that widening was really important and foundational to me.
Yeah. I want to ask about, you know, I like to think of like the really nitty gritty of situations like this. So if you told me, Joey, you're going to go to Thailand, you know, and I assume like, you know, in the cities and stuff, maybe it's easy enough to get around with English, but I'm sure you were in a lot of places where no one spoke English, and you're going to try to convince people to change their religion and you're going to do that all day. That would scare the hell out of me. And I can't imagine how many like awkward conversations you had and no's that you heard. But then, you know, now you're in a career where, you know, like to get into a professional illustration career or a professional motion design career, professional animation career, you're probably going to hear no a lot. And that can just totally crush people. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to hear like how, you know, I'd love to hear about your experience of like, I assume hearing no a whole bunch and being in really uncomfortable situations just socially. And how has that helped you in your career now that you're back in the United States and you're doing something a little more... you know, traditional, I guess.
I did learn Thai over the 18 months. And Thai people are very gracious. They're mm-hmm. very kind. They're willing to listen. But it is a lot of like, I mean, Buddhism is the national religion there. So like for a little white girl to come and be like, hey, you know, like, you want to like dump all this stuff. And yeah. So yeah, lots and lots of no's. They're a lot. I didn't have, I know people who serve in like the States or Britain where they get like doors slammed in their faces or like, you know, really aggressive, which, you know, I can understand some of that. But like Thai people are very like, oh, you're no, thank you. So right. A lot less harsh. But I was put in a lot of uncomfortable situations where I felt like, okay, well, I guess I'll just go talk to that person over there and hope.
Yeah.
It was uncomfortable. I had to grow a thick skin for better or for worse. I do. Yeah, I think that has helped me. I get a lot of, you know, potential projects that I really hope I'll be chosen for. And, you know, half the time it doesn't work out. And I have to kind of just like let it roll off my shoulders. When we first graduated from school too, my husband was trying to get into a studio, and it's really hard to get your first job in a studio. And there was a lot of no's and a lot of interviews that end in like, oh, you were our runner up. And when I was in Thailand, I almost had to like unpersonalize it from myself. Like, I'm just the messenger. Like, I'm just like, it's okay if they reject me. I feel like they're more rejecting the message or whatever. And so
the product,
the product. Yeah. And so if I get rejected for a job, you know, they're not rejecting like me necessarily. It just maybe my art wasn't the right fit or the circumstances weren't the right fit. Like, I don't have to take it as like a brutal, like, I'm worthless. Nobody wants me. It just wasn't the right time.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I could tell you, you know, as a 42-year-old man, I feel like that's a lesson I still could learn sometimes. Yeah, I mean, that's really cool. And you know, I know you mentioned you're not involved with the church anymore, but it's really cool that experience has still like meant so much and stuck with you. And I totally agree with you. Like, we try to travel as much as we can with our kids. Actually, when I was starting my freelance career, I asked one of the best designers I knew. I asked him, you know, what should I do? Like, how do I get good at this? And the advice he gave me was travel, which I thought was kind of weird. Now I get it. So for everyone listening, and it's funny, I think about this too, Emma, like, you know, School of Motion is an online school, and this is an online class. And there are things that, I think are better in some ways when you package education that way. But the experience you had, you can't have in an online class. You can have it at college. You can also have it going to Thailand for 18 months and doing something uncomfortable, though, which doesn't have to be associated with any church or anything like that. It can also be, and I had friends that just went away for a year to Europe. And they had similar experiences, so.
I don't necessarily think you even have, like, not everyone is privileged enough to be able to travel. But I think getting out in whatever way you can, whether that's taking a community class or serving in your community, like, just being out with people that you haven't met before will do that for you.
That's really good. All right, I guess we should probably talk about drawing at some point. This is so fascinating. Thank you for sharing all this with us.
Yeah, totally.
So I want to dig into the course. So you are teaching Character Design Fundamentals, which is only our second illustration course. And I'm super excited about this because we've been working together to put it together. I've been going through all the lessons as you finish them. And I think it's amazing. It's going to help a lot of people. So maybe you can just sort of tell everybody what is taught in this class.
So I basically condensed my 3-4 years of art training and refined it into like, what are the things that an artist getting started needs to know in order to design characters that like actually look like they could go into a production of some kind. So people don't know this, but a lot of design work is psychology or like understanding what makes the human brain tick and what makes people respond certain ways to certain things. Because at the end of the day, most people who are in animation or illustration are what the fine arts world would call sellouts, because we're making a product. We're selling a movie, a book, toys, whatever it is that you're illustrating or animating for. We're selling something. We want an audience to connect with our product and buy it or view it or whatever. So there's a lot of almost like marketing kind of stuff that goes into that, where it's like, well, who's my audience? How do they respond to certain images? And then how do I use all of that knowledge to create one, a story, but also a character that tells that story and then makes that audience like really engage with it and want to continue to interact with it, either by buying tickets or products or something. So that stuff that you can't really learn by just drawing a bunch or like copying other people's drawings, it's not like intuitive. You have to learn shape language and how that could be translated into telling a story. That's not something that you can just kind of be like, oh yes, I see, looking at this character design, I see how that is making me feel a certain way. Or someone has to teach you that. And I think that's where you don't have to go to art school, but you have to learn those things. And that's what this class is like teaching those the fundamentals of character psychology and design.
You have to, I think like with a lot of skills that we teach, you know, you can go from 0% to 100%, you know, ability, but really getting from like 0 to 80%, that's where you really need someone to push you and show you the things. Cause at some point you don't even know what you don't know. Once you get to that 80% mark, you know enough. And so to me, that's what this class is. I mean, there's a lot of things that you taught that like I'd heard before and like I kind of knew, but you show so many examples, like every single lesson, there's dozens and dozens and dozens of examples. You're drawing over things and it makes it to where all of a sudden there's like an aha moment in every video, which is really, really cool. And so I kind of see this class, there's really almost three parts to it. There's the psychology part you just talked about. There's the technique part. And then there's the practical, if you're going to be animating with this character, you need to think about these things, and this is how it's going to be presented in a professional kind of workflow. So why don't we kind of work through those? Let's start with the psychology part. So the way that you structured this class was, you know, at least the beginning part of it was around something we called the big three of character design. You mentioned one, shape language. So why don't we start there? What is shape language and you know, how do you use it like in your work?
Yeah, shape language is... It's the secret language of how shapes emit or elicit certain emotions from the human eye. So certain shapes are going to make someone think, oh, that's like soft and fluffy. And other shapes are going to make someone feel like, oh, I don't want to get close to that. And so when you can craft your image to like use those shapes with a very purposeful way, you're able to like pull out very specific reactions from people. And it's also when you use shape language, it's a really easy way to make a design look cohesive. I think a lot of beginners end up with kind of like chaotic looking designs that don't have any flow, or they can't figure out why their drawing just doesn't look, you know, like smooth. I don't know how to explain it. There's just a quality when you look at a professional character design, you're like, man, that just looks good. I don't know why. It just looks great. Whereas my drawings look weird and I don't understand why. It's because usually there isn't a flow. You're not using the language, right? So that's what shape language is.
Yeah. So that's one of them. And there's, you know, there's a whole lesson on that. You go really deep into it. The second big three was anatomy. And this is one, you know, like I've said this a million times on this podcast. I wish I could draw a lot better than I can. And part of it, especially if I try to draw any kind of character, is I don't actually know anatomy. And I think it's one of those things, like if you ask people to draw a bicycle, everyone thinks they know what a bicycle looks like until they try to draw it and they realize, no, you don't know what a bicycle looks like. I think I know the way a neck attaches to your chest, but I don't actually. Like there's muscles I don't think about. So how much anatomy did you have to learn in school? Or how much does anyone, even if you're not a professional illustrator, you just like, you're a motion designer, you're gonna make characters sometimes. How do you approach anatomy? How much do you need to know?
To be honest, you don't have to be an anatomy expert to be a good designer. You mostly need to know where are the essential connection points. What are some of the basic or like the largest muscle groupings? Where are the bone, like the like structural bones in the body? And then, I mean, the biggest part with anatomy is understanding proportions. If you can kind of know how many heads tall generally someone is, or how many eyes you can fit across your face. Like learning these little proportional tricks gets you to that 80% mark. And then the second, the 20% use reference, go and find like, well, what do muscles and the bicep look like? You know, it's once you can get the structure right so that it doesn't look like some giant troll or whatever with a tiny head. Once you get that right, then you can go and be like, all right, let's go and figure out like, what does the muscles here look like? Or yeah.
Right. Yeah. I like, you know, then the way you teach it and the way you just described it. I mean, there are a lot of little rules of thumb you can use and little hacks to get you halfway there. One of the things that was really cool, and I don't think I'd ever seen this before you taught it in the class, was this concept of baby face bias, which again is kind of this little hack. So maybe you could just like briefly describe what that is and how you use it. Before Emma answers, I wanna make sure you know about our in-depth motion design curriculum at School of Motion. We don't just offer classes that you can take anytime, like Emma's course, Character Design Fundamentals. We also offer interactive guided sessions that go deep into teaching you how to use tools like Photoshop, Illustrator, After Effects, and Cinema 4D. But more importantly, we teach you the principles of good design, animation, illustration, 3D, and much more. You get to learn alongside other artists, and you even get feedback and support from your own personal teaching assistant, a professional motion designer who is part of the School of Motion community. Find out more on our site. The link is in the description.
Babyface bias is a triangle. It's the eye-nose triangle. So if you could draw like a little triangle right here, the longer that triangle is on a face, the older and more cynical or maybe less approachable a character is going to look. And then the shorter it gets, the more baby it's going to look. So the reason that it's called babyface bias is because the concept of cute is because we're genetically designed to want to take care of babies, and a baby has big eyes, this like shortened eye nose triangle, they're really round, that just like makes your genes be like, ah, protect. And so if you put that little genetic coding in your brain into your design, that instantly makes an audience like be like, ah, I like that character, I want that character to succeed. So if you'll find that most protagonists in movies or you know whatever media you're consuming, they've got short baby face bias. Their nose is going to be kind of pushed up into their eyes. Even if they're old, characters, they'll have the short triangle.
I'm thinking of the, you know, the grandma from Encanto. She's got like this very kind of compressed face, mm-hmm. and it's so funny. Yeah. By the way, everyone listening, like literally like go look at, you know, like after you're done listening to this podcast, go watch some animated thing and you will now see this everywhere. This is one of those things. Now that you know it's a thing, you literally can't stop seeing it.
Yeah, you will unsee it.
So, okay. And then the last of the big three was motifs, which I think is like the most sort of esoteric. But again, once you understand it, you see it everywhere. So maybe you could talk a little bit about motifs.
Motifs are kind of a sister. They're adjacent to shape language. So once you kind of master shape language, you can kind of move into like the nuance of what kind of messaging can I sneak into my character? So if I've got a really sad character, I might make a teardrop shape motif. And then I'm just going to like cram that into as many places as I can in this character so that when a viewer sees this character, they just see sad teardrop shape and like, oh, sad. Or maybe if it's an arrowhead, you're just like tessellating that throughout the character design. Someone's going to say like, oh, well, like dangerous or fast or, you know, so it's a lot of subliminal messaging.
And again, like this is really obvious if you go and you watch, you know, like Disney movie Hercules or something like that. I think that's a really good example. But even in, you know, normal just sort of advertising motion design stuff, you still spot this stuff in the better designed characters. I'm curious what you think, you know, a lot of, like for a while, there's been this kind of default style that characters appear as when they're in like commercials. This mm-hmm. sort of, they have very long legs. There's a name for it. It's like
the Memphis
something style. Corporate Memphis or something like that. Yeah, I'm blanking on the name. But and there's not a lot of like obvious artistry in that, you know, I mean, originally I think it was created for like Facebook's like a house style, and it was designed to appeal to everybody and not feel, it was supposed to feel very safe. So that made sense, but then it kind of got applied to everything. And I'm curious as someone who draws characters all the time, when you see stuff like that, what do you think? Like, what's your reaction when you start seeing a style just, you know, appear everywhere like that?
Yeah, it feels very impersonal. And I think a lot of the time you just get executives who are like, oh, well, so-and-so did that we're going to do that too.
Yeah.
I understand why they started it, but it has really rolled out into way more. And I do feel like I see this happening in animation too, where one style get like Tangled got really popular when it came out. And you'll notice that every Disney movie since then looks like Tangled. Like all the main characters look like Rapunzel. And that happens a lot when the executives are like, well, that worked. So let's
keep that made a lot of money. Let's do that again.
and you'll talk to all the artists and they're like, man, like I did some really cool concept work in the beginning and they just like did not want it. And I think that when that happens, you kind of lose. I don't think that you're connecting with audiences as well if you're just relying on kind of this, well, like it's a cool, wacky graphic design style. Let's do that. They're not putting intent. I think advertising companies could sell better if they were like, well, what is an actual style that would connect with this very specific audience? Like, let's really think about who we're trying to sell to and like, let's come up with a style that is really going to like snag their attention instead of just being like, oh, well, this is a style that people do, I guess.
Exactly. I think intent, and I think that's even more and more important with now AI illustrations like starting to show up everywhere. And you can tell sometimes that it's like, oh, they just typed in the exact like name of the thing they wanted and they didn't think at all about the style of it and just posted it. And that's never going to be as effective. So let's talk about another aspect of this class is just basic drawing technique and specifically how it relates to drawing characters. And you know, this was something I asked you to include in the class, mostly for selfish reasons. And just for everyone listening, so this whole class takes place in Procreate. So it's like super accessible. And it's a lot easier, from my perspective, to draw in Procreate because you can hit undo. You just two-finger tap, you can undo, which you can't do on paper. But, you know, there's a bunch of material in this class about how to just get better at the act of drawing, sort of agnostic, you know, as to what you're actually drawing. And I'm curious, like over the years, what are some things that you've done that you find work really well, even just basic things like to get your arm to make the stroke that's in your mind and not be all squiggly and kind of crappy. You know, what advice and what tricks and practices do you have?
Training your arm is kind of the first hurdle for an artist. Being able to make the marks. I don't make my mark the first time still as a professional artist, but I am able to do it in fewer strokes now than before because I have trained it. So honestly, figure drawing, if you can get into a figure drawing class, is great for training your arm because you're holding your pen out from you. And then they really encourage you to draw from your shoulder. So it's and they want you to ghost. This is a figure drawing thing that I don't do as much now, but ghosting, so you kind of draw your line up, hovering over your paper, and then you make your mark.
You're practicing it before you draw it.
You're practicing it, yeah. You're visualizing it, and then you make your mark. And so that kind of stuff is the way that you get your arm to start behaving the way you want it to. And so that you don't have to go to a figure drawing class, but another way you could do that is filling a book or a sketchbook of just like circles, just like draw circles, fill a whole page of it, and then do squiggles and then do triangles. Like it doesn't have to be beautiful. It's literally just like getting your arm used to the motion. And even now, like it's a great warm up. Like before you sit down to draw, just fill a page of squiggles, see if you can get your arm moving in the way you want it to. So that is probably the first thing that someone should do if they're feeling uncomfortable drawing. They need to get used to making marks.
You said something in one of the lessons about, you know, having a sketchbook that I'm not sure I've heard anyone say before, but it like made something click in my head. And that's the sketchbook is not for you to show anybody. It's just for you. And it made me think of like, you know, I don't know, like if someone was like a fitness model or something, like you go to the gym and you're working really hard and you're sweating everywhere. You don't really want people to see that part. You want them to see you after that when you're like in good shape and doing that. So how do you like, I mean, I guess like in a very practical sense, like how do you use your sketchbook? I mean, is it literally like going to the gym for you?
Yeah, that's how I've never thought of it that way. It is the gym for artists. It's supposed to be your workbook. Like, it's for your warm-ups. It's for coming up with ideas. Like, I love sketchbooking also for thumbnails, for kind of getting out those initial ideas onto a page. It's great for studies. Emulation is something we cover in the course, which is like almost like doing master copies of an artist until you feel like you've gotten in their head so much that you could then design a character that looks exactly the way they would draw it. Sketchbooks are great for that because you don't want to show drawings that you've copied from someone else, right? But you got to do like 20 pages of copies before you can really be in that headspace. So filling up 20 pages in a sketchbook of just, oh, how does that artist draw their hands or how do they do line work? Like, it's purely for you. And it's so sad that there is this fear of a blank page. It's filling it without any kind of like expectation or hope that it's going to be something you want to show off is freeing. It's really the thing that is going to take your art from like down here up to here.
Yeah. Has that ever, you know, because we live in the age of social media still, and it does feel like there is a little bit of a pullback these days than there was maybe like 4 or 5 years ago. But, you know, when you draw something and it's in your sketchbook and you like it, there's this like inclination, I have to share it. Because if I don't, it's like I don't exist and I'll never get work. Like, how do you manage those feelings with actually being a professional artist and needing to post on social media occasionally?
That is hard when you kind of rely on posting stuff to attract new clients or make money. And this is actually something that I do know that a lot of working artists struggle to find time for sketchbook because you only have so much time and you kind of need to jump into getting your projects done. And so that's actually one of my goals for this year is I want to try to do at least 10 minutes of warm-up. And 10 minutes of warm-up may or may not give me something that I want to post later on, but it's more that I just want to, I want to grow more as an artist. I'm not done growing. I am still learning. And so I definitely want to be better about that for myself, like do what I preach. But I think if you're just somebody who's wanting to get better, don't put the pressure to share. Like, it's cool to see people posting their stuff online. And if you do draw something that you like and want to share, then you should share it. But that should not be your goal right now. I think there a lot of people see people with like 100,000 followers and they're like, oh, I want that too. That should not be your goal. As a new artist,
right?
As a new artist, you should be having fun and exploring.
Yeah, and I do like the idea of the sketchbook as the gym. You just, even when you wake up and you don't want to go, you got to make yourself go. You got to pull out that sketchbook. Let's talk about your career a little bit. So your BFA is in animation, and you obviously like know a lot about animation, but professionally, you're really an illustrator now. And I'm curious, like, when you decided to make the shift and why.
Yeah, so going back to the mission thing, that was fundamental for me as well because it triggered an identity crisis with my art. I got back, jumped right into the animation program. I was like, I don't know what I want to do anymore with this. Whereas before I was like, I'm going to get into Pixar. I'm going to like be a lead designer. And then I was like, as I was going through the program, I was like, I don't know if I want to be in a studio or... I don't know. It just like, I was in this weird place where I didn't know what I wanted to do after school. And so I graduated and I got married. and so my husband was applying to studios and I was like, I don't know, like if he gets a job at this studio, like I would have to really hope that I could get a job that was, you know, within driving distance. Or I was like, well, maybe I could do freelance. And so I started thinking about freelance. And also my last year of art school, I got this like random children's book gig from a friend. And so I was wrapping that up. And then after we moved away, they came back and like, we're going to like really expand it. We're going to do a big Kickstarter. Do you want to do that for us? I was like, sure, like money, I'll do it. And then it was just so much fun working with them that I was like, that was actually like really cool. And I haven't really considered the children's book side of things before. And so I ended up throwing together a portfolio. I was like, well, I'll just do this while I'm figuring it out. So I threw together a portfolio. I had friends that were represented by this one agency, and they picked me up. And so I started like doing work that I like didn't even know existed, like magazines and like children's educational things. And the more I was doing, I was like, this is like really fun. And this feels like home to me, creating still images that tell a story. And so I kind of just like fell into it as I was figuring myself out. I feel like it was a lesson in allowing time for myself to explore new things. And so now I just stayed. And so here I am, and I've been learning the ins and outs of illustration on my own by just doing it, getting clients and making mistakes and stuff. So I just kind of fell into it, honestly.
So what is, you know, I think like most of the people listening to this or watching this, you know, it's pretty easy for them to imagine, okay, if I go work at a studio, I kind of know what my life looks like. I kind of know what that career looks like. Or if I'm a freelance motion designer, I kind of know what that looks like. But you're in the world of illustration, which I feel like it's a little bit different for some reasons. You know, there's concepts in that world that don't exist in motion design. Like I know you can license your drawings, you know, and things like this. And also just by the nature of it, it feels like, you know, the projects are probably not as long. Like you could be on a motion design project or a film for months or years, but if someone commissions you for an illustration, it's not gonna take that long, right? Mm-hmm. So what is like on a practical day-to-day level, what is an illustration career, especially the way you're doing it as a freelancer with some representation, what does that look like?
It's a lot of, I've learned diversification, at least for me. I found that having multiple sources of income to kind of sustain me as there's like levels in illustration. There's kind of like, when you first get in, you're kind of just taking whatever jobs you can get. It's a lot of like it could take you a month to 2 months to finish your projects, or like those are the deadlines they give. And it could just be for any old client that you can get your hands on. And a lot of times it's matching styles that they want you to match. And so you're kind of just surviving and doing what you can kind of in that those beginning stages as you're working on your portfolio, building a social media presence, making a name for yourself so that you can move into the next level, which is like, oh, I really like your art. I want you to draw something in your style, where at that point you're also able to negotiate your prices higher. So kind of in that first stage, it's a lot of like, well, what are, like, I want to make sure that I can do lots of styles so that I can work in a wide variety of mediums, whether that's like education, or I've like worked on doing character designs for a random short film. You know, it's just like whatever could like come my way. I wanted to be able to say like, I could do that. I could do that. I could do that. You know, but just to like feed myself while I'm like working on my portfolio to be like, hey, like this is me, hire me for this, you know? So it's a lot of flexibility.
I mean, that's so similar to, you know, it's like the advice I give to people starting out in this field too. It's like, you can be a specialist and be known for your style and your art, but the only way that's gonna happen is if you're amazing at it, because it's very competitive. And generally that takes a long time. And so in the beginning, it's a lot easier to have a broad set of skills that you're pretty good at, figure out which ones you love and work on those, and just take time until all of a sudden you're really good at one or two of those, and then you can just do those things. So it's interesting that illustration kind of works the same way. I know you have a lot of illustrators that you look up to and artists and stuff like that. And I'm always curious, like, what, when you look at an illustrator, maybe you can throw out some names and give people props if you want. What are things that you look at in other illustrators' work that you're like, oh my God, I wish I could do that. That's too difficult for me, or I just don't know that technique, or, you know, or is it even different than that? Is it like the thoughts they're having, the ideas they have? I'm curious what you look up to in other illustrators.
Yeah, right now, so people like Mikey Plensky is like she's a smaller known illustrator in the middle grade that I just think that she's so good at telling story. Like, she just sets her stage in a way that I just can look at the characters and know exactly what they're thinking. She uses her colors and her lighting in a way that frames them in just like a really beautiful way. I really am she's a huge inspiration for me. Another artist who I just think is like a master of color is Maxine V. Her colors are out of this world. I just like, every time she posts something, I just have to stare at it for like 3 minutes because it's fantastic. And she just started doing like little scenery paintings and posting them online. And then now she's doing book covers. So her stuff, her just like, she uses shapes in her colors too. So like, she's really good at using, she doesn't do line drawings. She just does paintings, but she's got shape language in her paintings, which is like, blows my mind. For character designers, I mentioned him in the course, but Corey Loftus is like the king of character design in my mind. He's got amazing line weight, but then just his like, the characters he makes are so fascinating. I don't know how he does it, but they're just the most human, non-human, weird, but interesting character designs I've ever seen. And like, he's been art director on multiple Disney productions. I think he was like lead character designer on Zootopia. And he just is able to take any like animal, human, creature, like he makes those things that you want to like be with and get to know. He's just really fantastic at storytelling with not only just like his designs, the shapes, but like he goes into the nitty-gritty with details, little like hairs on a chin. Like he just puts little details that you wouldn't think, that seem so small, but they make a big difference.
Yeah, there was a term that I remember used in the class, and you'll have to remind me what it is, but it's basically the idea that if you want to have, let's say, like a bad guy character, and you want to make them look kind of repulsive, there's a way to do that where they're still appealing, and there's like this fine line you have to draw where
clean dirt.
If you want a character, what is it called? Clean dirt, that's right, yeah. I love that, yeah. And it's like if you're going to have a character that's like really old, well, you could make them look old in a way, you know, where they have like liver spots and stuff and it's really kind of, you know, gnarly. Or you could treat them respectfully and you still can't stop staring at the character. How do you develop that kind of sensibility? Like, how do you know when it's you've gone too far?
Understanding appeal helps. Like, what, how far can you push something? It's just, it's kind of like this third sense you have to gain, but understanding things like Uncanny Valley, using reference, like if you watch a show, you can see how far they'll go to like add dirt. And there are definitely some shows that really ride that line of appeal, but it does seem to me like it is a bit of a third sense. If you show it to your grandma and she's just like, ah, you know, like,
right, right.
You probably went too far, right? Like, if she's like, oh, that's interesting, but okay, cool. Like, then maybe you've brought it back, you know, like,
yeah.
It's kind of getting a gauge for how people react to your drawings. If people are like, I don't want to look at that anymore, you need to start reining it in.
I'm thinking of that character at the end of Box Trolls. I don't know if you've seen that, where he's eating the cheese and he's having an allergic reaction. And it's just ghastly. Yeah.
That was actually my biggest complaint for that movie. I felt
really?
Like they took it too far. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah. I mean, it was definitely hard to watch, but I don't know. I kind of liked that they took it too far, but that's interesting. Okay. And so like, can you think off the top of your head, are there any other examples of things where you're like, I think that was too far?
That's actually funny you brought up Box Trolls because that's always the one I bring up.
I assume you've seen SpongeBob SquarePants at some point. Like,
yes.
Every once in a while, they'll cut to a close-up of him or something, and they'll make him look so realistic.
But they only keep it on screen for a couple seconds, and it's not moving.
Yeah.
So, like, they know. Like, they're using that very intentionally, right? Because they're like, okay, this is really going to gross people out. If they, like, animated that, people would be like, ooh, I don't want to watch that, you know?
Yeah, I love that you used a really good example in the course where you were talking about, you know, how like you need to have appeal. And if you make things too realistic, it just totally ruins it. And you showed some 3D rendering of Homer Simpson if he had like real skin. And it was like, it gave me nightmares. It's one of the creepiest images I've ever seen.
That's Uncanny Valley.
It's true. Uncanny Valley. Okay, so let's start to land the plane here. What, you know, you've done like a bunch of different types of work in your career and you're still kind of like, you know, you're early-ish in it, right? So what are you aiming at? Like, what would be like a dream gig or a dream client to work with?
Well, like for big goals, like I would just really love to be the kind of artist that I get to do 4 books a year that pay me really well. And if I want to take some smaller covers or whatever other random jobs come my way, if I've got the time for it, then I could do those extra things. But you kind of like know you've made it when you're doing 3 to 4 books that are paying you like really well for each book. That's kind of like broad goals for me. But like my a random dream client of mine is Hasbro's Monster High Dolls. I would love to design stuff for them. I've always like really liked dolls, fashion dolls. And I don't, it's random and weird, but I think that designing dolls that are also monsters in cool clothes, super cool, super fun. I would love to do that.
Well, I know you worked with American Girl. Were you, like, were you into them when you were young?
That was one that we were too poor to play with. I would look at
they
the
are
magazines.
Super expensive. Yeah, yeah. Found out the hard way.
Yeah, that was really cool for me. That's probably one of the highlights of my career so far is illustrating two American Girl books. Yeah.
Well, and it's all on your website. They're beautiful illustrations. We're going to link to everything, so everyone you know listening to this or watching it, go to Emma's site, check it out. Last thing I want to ask you. So first of all, like anyone who this sounds interesting and wants to get better at this sort of thing, check out the class. All the information's in the description. Emma poured like so much love and time and effort into this, and it's an amazing class. And if you want to get better at drawing, if you use character at all in your work, I highly recommend checking it out. The thing about drawing is that to me anyway, and this might just be, you know, me in my own headspace, but it's so, it's brutal sometimes when you're not good at it and you have this idea in your head and you, no matter what, it just will not come out. Your arm will not do it. And I imagine that probably you still feel that way sometimes, even though you've been doing this for years and you're very good at it. And I'm curious if you have any advice for people that, you know, because there is this like dip you have to push through to get good at something like drawing. It's the same with the animation, but drawing for some reason is more painful for me. Do you have any advice for people that get discouraged and they feel like it's just never going to happen? And really you just need to hit that sketchbook some more.
Yeah. So hitting sketchbook, definitely. I think one thing that newer artists don't do that is a game changer when you start doing it is asking for critique, because, you know, my husband's an artist. So if I'm really stuck on a drawing, I'm like, this looks weird. I cannot figure out why. I just take it to him and he's like, oh, well, duh, like your arm is in the wrong spot or like your vanishing point is like totally screwed up. And he like does a little draw over. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, why didn't I see that before? So I think it's can be scary as a new artist because you're like, oh, like be kind to me. But at the end of the day, you're going to be grateful that you got the feedback, because then you can come back and be like, oh, like I didn't see that because I was too like kind of focused in on it. You can also take a step back. So I think sometimes people have a hard time with the drawing and then they crumple it up and throw it over their shoulder. Instead of doing that, you could just like set it down, go for a walk, touch grass, I don't know, whatever, you know, spend a couple days from it. You come back and a lot of times your subconscious has been working on that problem kind of in the background. When you come back to it, you're like, okay, I can do this. And then you can finish your drawing. But if you're like in a larger block, there's like a big, you're just like not creative or everything you're drawing is turning out bad. I just say draw what you know, draw what's fun. I think this was something that actually was a big hindrance to me in art school, was that I was surrounded by all this like these amazing professors who were showing me like these are like the best artists in the industry right now. And then I'm like, okay, well, I better start drawing what they're drawing. And I kind of stopped drawing the stuff that I wanted to draw. And I think that the point of all of this is to have fun, to create stuff that people enjoy. And if you're not having fun, then you're not creating stuff that people are going to enjoy. So don't forget to draw what you want to draw. I think in one of our podcasts, I was interviewing my friend Kim. And she's like, if I don't know what to draw, I draw unicorns. And that usually helps because unicorns are easy for her to draw. She likes them. It kind of gets her in a happy place. And so she draws unicorns. So if there's something like that for you, draw that. And maybe that will help kind of remind you why you're doing all of this.
Check out Character Design Fundamentals, available now on our site. The link is in the description. And I want to thank Emma for working so hard on this class. It's really amazing. And I can't wait to see the results that her students are going to get after taking it. Make sure you also check out her portfolio at emmagilletteart.com so you can see the incredible level of skill Emma brings to her work. Thanks so much for watching, and make sure you are subscribed so you don't miss anything from School of Motion, and I will see you soon.